Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day Gladys and Potties, welcome to another Classic LNL. It's a conversation I had in October 1996 with a bloke who'd been a dear friend for over 40 years, Jim Cairns, the late James Ford Cairns, if you like, PhD. Jim began his working life as a copper. Before moving into academia, he taught economic history at the University of Melbourne. He then became a member of the House of Reps, this was in 1955, and went on to serve as Deputy Prime Minister and Federal Treasurer under, well, Gough Whitlam, who wasn't happy about that at all. He was the intellectual leader of the political left. He was charismatic, he was remarkable, and he was mildly eccentric. And he was committed to working for social and economic reform.
Johann Sebastian and he of the lacerated larynx welcome you to another week of Late Night Live and to the second in a two-part series where I have meandering chats with influential and apparently indestructible octogenarians. My previous effort was with an old combatant, B.A. Santa Maria. This time it's with an old friend, J.C. No, not that one, although I think we have him booked for next week. Now, this is the equally messianic Jim Cairns. Now, Jim, I thought we'd just sit down for an hour and just natter about old times, good times, bad times, and what the hell's going on in the world as you see it. But I'm going to start with something that you said off-air. You just found a button, one of thousands of buttons in front of you, on the panel, which you'd misread as gough. It does, in fact, read cough, and it's there to cover in little explosions from the aforementioned larynx. Jim, had it, in fact, said gough, would you have pressed it?
Well, not if it interfered with this program, but...
I just thought it was a charming Freudian slip that you might have thought it was...
Well, actually...
You talked about your erstwhile colleague.
Yes, I haven't heard for ages from them, but Gwen said, had a ring from Whitlam's office. He wanted to know your address. So she gave the address. I don't know what it's for.
Well, look, it reminds me, of course, of that one of the moments in our lives when our paths crossed. Let me set the scene. You're, in fact, very ill. You're lying in bed at Hawthorne, surrounded by a million jars of pills and things. Whitlam has spat the dummy. He's chucked away the leadership in a fit of pique. And
right.
You have decided to have a go for the job.
Yeah.
And I'm induced to come over by a mutual friend because he thinks that your campaigning letter to the caucus is too polite. So I rough the letter up a bit. But the letter begins with that wonderful phrase of yours, whose party is it? You know, Gough's or ours?
Yes, that's right.
Now, I think the listener has probably forgotten how close you came to winning that particular tussle. There was only a couple of votes in it, wasn't
there? Two votes either way made the difference. Yes, it did. And I got several that I hadn't expected, and I didn't get a couple that I might have got, so it was very close indeed.
Jim, I remember at the time you saying you didn't want to win. You thought that you would be politically unacceptable to the electorate. Why did you stand Gough up on that?
Because he was moving very significantly to the right. He was dealing with Harradine. And there was a move coming in which there would have been a significant number of former DLP members and candidates readmitted to the party and probably endorsed for seats in Parliament against some of the others. Gough was distinctly and definitely moving very much to the right at that time. Now, not only did my very close proximity to him stop him doing that, but he took on quite a different move, really. And the policy with which we eventually won in 1972 was a progressive policy. And it came out of Whitlam realising that he couldn't effectively in the circumstances, move to the right.
Jim, I know that what-if games are pretty meaningless, but what if the votes had fallen the other way? What if you'd got that narrow majority? What would have become, do you think, of the Labour Party with you as its leader?
Well, I would, in brief terms, I'd have moved it to the left, but whether or not I would have lasted a year or two, I very seriously doubt. I think there would have been a very intense media, right-wing public service, economic rationalist campaign against me. And frankly, Philip, I don't think I could have survived that. I think a year or two would have finished me off.
Well, Jim, no one in the Labour movement in modern history has attracted more flack than you. What is it about your personality, your politics, that has always made you such a popular target?
Look, the determining forces in society, whether they know it or not, consciously or otherwise, are out to keep you in step. They want people everywhere to act like sheep. There are several rams I could name, and you could half a dozen of those quite easily. Two or three of them live in Sydney. Now, they want to keep the sheep in step. If one of them frequently or continuously gets out of step, they immediately try to force them back into step. And that's what happens in politics, as in every other place. Every other employment is in the same way. You get on by pleasing the boss. As Mr. Murdoch's top man said the other day, when he comes into the office, everybody knows by the look in his eye what they should do.
Well, you didn't please the boss with that little campaign of ours. He didn't talk to me for about a year. He never...
Oh, no.
It seems to me... I seem to remember that he never called you by your name. He never called you Jim.
No, he never called me Jim. I think he probably called me Cairns when he was talking to others. But as far as I know, rarely ever did he call me Jim.
Yeah. So we'll have to wait and see what the letter is in the mail, won't we, Jim, to
yes,
see
we will.
Perhaps there's
yeah.
been a rapprochement. You never know.
I doubt it, but you never know.
OK, let's go back to Melbourne in 1914, to your birth. What sort of family background are we dealing with, Jim? Middle class, lower middle class?
Well, you could hardly fit them into a class at all. You see, my grandmother and grandfather were very distinctly working class in England. Just outside Manchester, my grandfather began work in a cotton mill at the age of 9 years and worked at that time and for a number of years afterwards as much as 60 hours a week. Now, they came to Australia as a result of savings out of an income like that. In the meantime, he'd been married once before, by the way. In the meantime, he married again and had a number of children and could afford to bring those children to Australia at a fare of less than £10 per person. They came on the Benalla in 1913 and arrived in Melbourne. Now, when they got here, they took a house at 22 Drummond Street, Carlton, which is still there, still unmarked, unchanged, don't think it's even been painted. The front room has still the same floor, the same mantelpiece over the fireplace in which I was born. Now, they stayed there for about 18 months. Then my grandfather managed to get a job, and I never heard how, from Sir Rupert Clark, who was the owner of Rupert's Wood just outside Sunbury. And he was the first Australian, he wasn't an Australian, but the first baronet to live in Australia. So my grandfather went and worked for him, did so for about 2 years, and they wanted to be farmers. So they leased a farm between Melton and Toolan Vale, and I moved with them at the age of four onto that farm.
Jimmy, you've described a childhood with little physical affection within the family, but a great deal of intellectual curiosity.
Yes, there was a great deal of thinking curiosity. My grandmother was a tremendous reader of the New Testament, hardly ever touched the Old, And I read a fair bit of the New Testament and used to have discussions, yes, debates with her, because there were a number of things that even at the age of 7 or 8 I disagreed with her about, and we had quite a lot of discussions about that. Now, insofar as we were being intellectual, it was about that subject, and that was the sum total, if you might put it, of my intellectualism, until well after I got to the primary school, after we'd moved back to Sunbury. At the end of the Gap Road, I saw it yesterday as I drove past going to the Loddon prison to talk to the chaps there. I saw the old place, what's left of it, plus a very new house on the hill nearby. Now, we moved on to that farm, the first one we owned. They'd put a small deposit on it. The National Bank really owned it. And when the Depression hit us hard in 1930, the bank took possession of the farm, and my grandparents had to leave there.
Now, Jim, there's a couple of threads emerging already. There's the New Testament, there's the Depression. But I want to go back and ask you about a mystery in your life, something I've never been able to fathom, and that is the story of your father.
Yes, well, I've got a very impressive photograph of him. I know he exists. I don't ever remember seeing him. He and my mother met on the Benalla. He came out on the same ship. They married soon afterwards. Very soon afterwards, he enlisted in the Australian Imperial Force and went overseas as a lieutenant. The photograph I have of him was taken as a lieutenant just before he left. Now, he wrote a number of letters, and he had a beautiful handwriting, and I have great regret that I never kept these letters, because it showed what you might call the radical intellectual change that was taking place in him during his service with the Australian forces in France. He could see how badly everything was done. He became completely disillusioned with the British general staff, with the authorities. Everything that was of value in his life, like British society, British status, and so on, by 1917 had disappeared. Now, eventually, when the war came to an end, he went back to Northern Ireland, to Belfast nearby, where his sister, two sisters, and a brother still lived. They were part of the Cairns family. And he stayed with them for 2 or 3 weeks. Then he said he was going, and they thought, going back home to Australia. But he didn't. He went to Africa. And he was in Africa for about 6 or 7 years, the evidence is, according to my aunt, when he committed suicide by using a hose pipe on the exhaust of a car. So he never came back to Australia.
And does this strange absence in your life, has this affected you?
Yes, it would undoubtedly. If you don't have a father close by, undoubtedly that affects you one way or another. I can't imagine, I can't possibly work out what his influence would have been had he been there, but it wasn't there. My grandfather didn't exactly replace him. I had great respect for my grandfather. We got on very well together, but never very deeply. I had much more depth with my grandmother. Not much with my mother or aunt, for that matter. They were the only other two people regularly in the house. My mother had to begin work in 1921 because we had no income, so she, with my aunt, began as a cook in the mental hospitals working at Sunbury up on the hill. It was a wonderful, efficient, clean, business-like kitchen that they had, and there were then, I think, if I'm not wrong, 1,500 patients in the wards on the hill at Sunbury, for which these two, with some patient assistants, cooked. Now, they remained in that job and came home when we were living at Milton through most of this time, about 15 miles away. Each weekend they came home with a horse and buggy to visit us, each second weekend, not each weekend. So I saw my mother only every second weekend, and I never had the closeness with her that I think is essential for a child if he is to fully develop.
Jim, it's interesting that you and I have parallels here. My father disappears. I'm raised by grandparents. I see my mother occasionally. I'm on a small farm as well. And like you, I'm at a young age, I'm thinking about rather sizable issues. But I became interested in politics in my early teens. When did you start to focus? When did these various threads in your life push you towards the ALP?
I became interested in economic and political questions at the age of about 15 at Northcote High School. But not in political action and not the ALP. The Depression was at its height. I was unemployed myself after leaving Northcote High School for a year. And the Depression had hit us pretty heavily. I was recognised as a good debater from the age of 15 in house debates at school. I was always number one man in the Darabin House team. And we debated such things as the Depression is caused by, and believe it or not, lack of effective demand. We put a case in that debate which had all the substance in it, later the work of John Maynard Keynes in 1936 in General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, really had.
Well, you were a very early Keynesian, weren't you?
That's right. It was common sense. The substance of Keynes is common sense. Like the absence of Keynes today in economics is simply a complete throwing aside of common sense. There's no common sense whatever in rational economics. It's thrown aside any substance and any rationalism for that matter.
You're listening to Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, ABC Online and via podcast. And this extended interview with the late Jim Cairns was first broadcast in 1996.
We'll get back to that later. I just want to keep going through the chronology here.
Now, yeah.
The Depression hits you with a great wallop.
Yes.
You can't find regular work. You join the police force in the mid-30s.
Oh, not for a while. There's another important thing before that. We moved to Melbourne when the bank sold us out. We lived in Elwood and Rippenlea, Sycamore Grove, Rippenlea, number 30, Sycamore Grove, still there. And I began going to Northcote High School. I continued to go to Northcote High School. I had travelled all the way from Sunbury to Northcote High School, 76 miles a day. I continued to go there. Having left school, I then began from Rippenlea to look for a job, and 12 months could not find one. In the end, one day, I put in an application for a junior clerk's position with the Australian Estates and Mortgage Company. And strangely enough, I got a job with them, one of two that were appointed that day. The other one was the man who became Sir William Vines. Now, when I got into that office downstairs at the corner of Williams and Little Collins Street, every other character had gone either to a public school or to a grammar school, except me, and I was the only one.
You were the scrubber.
Yes, I was the scrubber in every way. Now, for about 3 years, not roughly or overridingly, they treated me as the scrubber. I was working 60 hours a week for 19 shillings a week. Everybody else was working long hours too, even the public school boys. And the thing that then came to me as a way of being was athletics. I'd done well in athletics at school. I had been induced into Melbourne Harriers, Australia's oldest athletic club, before leaving school. And I used to get down to Olympic Park, if I could, on Tuesdays and Thursday nights, and began to train, and continued to train fairly intensely for athletics, in which I won two Victorian championships, both of them in 1939. Now, getting down late to train, I used to never warm up properly, and one day I damaged the thigh muscles in the back of my left thigh. And I was sent to see a masseur, Granville Dunstan, in Collins Street to have that treated. While I was there, I was telling him of my woes, my great woes, and all this. And he said, "Oh, you must meet a friend of mine." Now, the friend next day turned out to be a man who wore a beautiful grey suit, highly polished tan shoes, and when I looked up the length of the suit, found it wasn't very long, it was only about 5'6". And who should it turn out to be but Sir Thomas Fleming, who was then the Commissioner of Police. Well, I was introduced to him with a kind of link that continued until well after the war.
Jim, yes, this is a bloke who, according to legend, was sort of plotting some sort of coup of tat at some time that he was...
He never told me about it, and...
But you know that he had these impeccable sort of ultra-right-wing connections. He's a strange mentor for you.
Well, I don't know about his impeccable right-wing connections. I suppose as a 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old young fellow or young policeman, when I worked directly for him, when the Melbourne Herald was trying to overthrow him and the control of the Victorian Police Force, I worked directly to Blamey and from Blamey, and I saw quite a lot of him. He lived in South Yarra at the bottom of Punt Road. Now, I was a shadower, a dog, you see. Now, I saw quite a lot of him, and frankly, Philip, I never saw any connections at all. He seemed to have very few friends. He didn't go to places like the Melbourne Club. They didn't have parties at home. If he had connections, they were very difficult for me to find.
In any case, it was a parenthetical observation.
It isn't
important. But you were, in fact, a very good Wall, weren't you? Because you were commended for bravery after being involved, as I understand it, in a gunfight with a notorious Melbourne crim.
Well, I was involved in a gunfight, and I got, only the other day, I went to the 50th anniversary of the detective training school, and they gave me a copy of my record, and it shows 9 highly commendatory entries for that sort of thing, one of which was a shooting affair, yes. I found that it was all very exciting, and I didn't feel that it was difficult to handle. Most of the... people I dealt with, the criminals I dealt with, I talked to. I was able to find out the reasons why they had done what they had done and how it could have been prevented. I was even doing that yesterday at Loddon.
So for you it's a nurture rather than nature argument, isn't it?
Of course it is. It's not nature. Nature is inherently good. What goes wrong and goes right substantially happens after conception and through our lives. I was mentioning to them yesterday that I had an operation to my chest some 15 or 16 years ago. When I was being moved into the operating theatre, along came this character dressed all in green and looked pretty dangerous. And he said, "I'm the anaesthetist." He said, "I was in your classes at Pentridge after the war. And I decided I'd study medicine and I'd become an anaesthetist." And half a dozen cases like that happened in my experience.
We're listening to Jim Cairns, and let me remind you, Jim, that in 1939 you marry Gwen, you inherit 2 kids from a previous marriage, your mother disapproves, you join the army late in the war in 45, get you out of the police force. At this time you must also be, and I'm not sure that Cairns would have been enough for you, were you flirting with Marx?
Oh, yes, I had been, I'd studied history of economic thought very thoroughly at Melbourne University, and Marx was part of that. I suppose I would have thought by that time that you've just mentioned that Marx was the most important and significant writer of them all. I don't do so now, but I thought so then, and I was very happy to be teaching Marx when I went to Moratai in the Army Education. I had these classes. We had as many as 100 soldiers who used to walk 2 miles up the road and come to where we were.
And who were very ready to listen, weren't they, Jim?
Very ready to listen. Very ready indeed to listen.
That was very common in the Australian Army, I understand.
It was very common. And many of them gained post-war scholarships to study at the university. And in the years I was there from 46 to 51, before I went overseas, 3/4 of the people in my class, in the classes of commerce, were former army students, former soldiers. And I'd have as many as 1,000 of them in the public lecture theatre. Anyone who knows the public lecture theatre in Melbourne and can imagine 1,000 students sitting there in the aisles and everywhere else would know what a lecture in that place was like. It's never been equal since.
But Jim, my first memories of you are in fact sitting in rather dank little rooms at the back of the Richmond Town Hall where you were lecturing members of the ALP. You were a bloody good lecturer. Mm. I mean, you really loved it, didn't you? You had a gift
for
it.
Oh, yes, I have a gift for it. I find it very tiring because in an hour and a half or 2 hours, I put just about everything I've got in it into it, and I feel very tired at the end of it, still do. Still did yesterday.
Mm. But you need a bigger lecture hall, and so Parliament becomes available. You become a member in 55. How old were you in 1955?
I was 41. Wow. It was just about my 41st birthday, actually.
Now, that means that you and Malcolm Fraser would have entered Parliament at the same time.
On the same day. Malcolm was only 27 and I was 41. That was the difference, but we entered on the same day.
One of the charming stories about your maiden speech, I understand that they were back-to-back, you and Malcolm's, was that Robert Menzies broke convention and crossed the floor to congratulate you.
Yes, he came round the back of the speaker's chair and came over to where I was on the left-hand side at the very end and congratulated me on the speech and said that he was very interested and he would give some attention to what I'd been saying.
Yes, he marked you down, didn't he, for future attention?
That's right.
But the fact, I remember telling people over the years that you had this quite a strong friendship and they find it hard to believe.
It never really much came out. I suppose it came out more thoroughly after he retired from Parliament than it ever did before. It came out first because of me being hit on the head in that brawl we had at our house. And he came round to our place, but he had now left Parliament, came round to our place, being driven there in his beautiful black Bentley, and wanted to know how I was and all that. And I saw him several times after that, when he was living in Haverback Avenue, Malvern.
Mm.
He came twice to functions at Richmond Town Hall that I had organised, saying he'd never been to a function in the Richmond Town Hall before, and he very much regretted that.
Yes, amazing image, really.
Yeah.
If only the listener could imagine Richmond Town Hall and the resonance of it. They would understand how surprising that is.
Yes.
There's not much in the way of cross-branch friendships these days, is there? I think since 75 they shriveled.
I don't really know. Since 77, I have gone to Canberra very little, really. I've been to Parliament, I suppose, only half a dozen times since 1975. I don't see many. I see Tom Uren very frequently. I see Frank Crean, but only just passing one another at the Foran Market. But beyond that, I hardly see any of them. That's, of course, very much the result of the fact that I don't travel much as it is of anything they do. Bert James came down from near Newcastle to the launching of my book 3 weeks ago and enjoyed it very much, Bert James. But apart from one or two others, they were the only members of Parliament, state or federal, who turned up for the launching of my book.
But, Jim, in a way, you emphatically departed politics. You turned your back on it. You, in fact, started to talk about the unimportance of politics because you'd had a paradigm shift in your own life and thinking, hadn't you?
Yes. The reading of Willem Reich, R-E-I-C-H, was the turning point in my thinking. I learned from Reich and later from Freud, and Freud is relatively simple, and despite all his complexities, that it is repression that is the essence of the possibilities of human progress. And
but you're talking specifically sexual repression as opposed to political
sexual
repression.
Sexual and organic.
Yeah.
Yeah, but political repression is always originated with sexual and organic repression and would not occur if that did not occur.
But this, of course, is a remarkable change for someone who spent their life in politics. And generally, people didn't know how to cope with you, did they? I mean, your old political mates just couldn't comprehend what you were saying and didn't really want to listen.
They couldn't comprehend it, yes. They were not, well, capable of trying. And they put it down to my old age silliness rather than anything very serious.
Well, some of them put it down to you being hit on the head at Hawthorne. You know, there was also a belief that that attack, that appalling attack, where you and Gwen were very badly knocked about, was influential.
Only one man I've ever heard of said that, but I suppose there would be others as well.
Mm. Incidentally, I often tell people that if they want to get a glimpse of Jim Cairns, it's not a bad thing to see the Costa Gravis film Z or Zed, because the central character in that film has always reminded me of you, Jim. Now, of course, he's properly assassinated in the film. You were just badly injured.
Uh-huh.
Before then, of course, we've jumped ahead a long way, but before then, the whole sort of upheaval, the tumult and the shouting of the Whitlam years has come and gone. Prior to that, of course, you had the great battle over the Labour Party split, where you were actively opposed against B.A. Santa Maria and the movement and the groupers. When you think back on that whole political era, what is it that you remember most vividly? What is the moment? Is it you leading the moratorium marches? Is it your sort of the struggle with Whitlam? Is it the exhilarations of 72? What?
Well, Philip, I suppose, as I've said before, the most significant day in, I think, in my experience was the 8th of May 1970, the first 100,000 moratorium in Bourke Street, which was absolutely and completely peaceful and absolutely and completely effective.
And there you were at the head of it.
In a sense, yes, I was, but there were another 20 or so people who gave the same kind of leadership. And the significant thing about that was that the majority of people who took part were able to watch and to follow. And they did what those 20 or so people indicated, including me, wanted to have done, and so the march was completely ineffective. There was hardly any deviation from it, and I make the point that the police cooperated 100% with what we were doing, although they were afraid of the outcome too, as I was, until 3:15 that afternoon when I was no longer afraid. It was the most important day in my life. Now, was it? Why was it? It was, first of all, because it was a day of 100,000 people. They had a human energy that could be felt when you were in it. I've never had that kind of experience before or since. Now, it was also important because it demonstrates to people what democracy really is. You see, Parliament is a stage play, like anything else on television. Now, you don't have much effect on Parliament because you only vote once every 2 or 3 years between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. You can't have much effect on Parliament. If democracy has got to mean anything, it's got to be collective action by the people over something that is of importance. So the moratorium on the 8th of May 1970 was the clearest possible example we've seen of precisely that.
This is Classic LNL, ABC Radio National, etc. My guest for the program, originally broadcast 11 years ago, was former academic, anti-war activist, Labour Deputy Prime Minister Jim Cairns, who died in October 2003, aged 89.
Jim, it was in many ways the apotheosis of the left and others, because it was a broad church, the moratorium march. But has it not been a sad story ever since? I mean, in a sense, that was the mountain. The valley seemed to have got deeper and deeper.
Only apparently, Philip. I find it difficult to explain the takeover of economic rationalism, of the political parties, of Parliament, of business leaders, of the media, and in the same way, of the man and woman in the street.
You mean their acquiescence to it, their surrender to it as a philosophy?
And their practice of it is. It's very difficult to understand why it happened. You can look at it and put it down to people like Stone and Shan and people like that in the Treasury, and the Reserve Bank, which came under their control. You can put it down to the effect that these people had on and with first Hayden, to a lesser extent with Fraser, and then with Keating, to explain its growth in the federal parliament. But the same sort of thing has come about not only in the federal parliament in Canberra, but in every state parliament and in each state government, so that none of them, Labor or any other, now has any other values than money values.
And this is true of the Western democracies, all
of them. It's true in England. There's a slight deviation coming up in New Zealand. But it's true in England. It's true in Europe. Yes, as you say, it's very disappointing and it's very serious. And what can be done about it?
Well, Jim, you tried, first of all, to explore the other world that we've been talking about briefly. You decided to explore the world of repression, of Wilhelm Reich, and then more recently, it seems to me, you've tried to hybridise. In other words, you've re-engaged with political thought. I mean, the new book, Reshaping the Future, does two things, does it not? Does it not attempt to make a bridge between the personal and the political?
Yes, it does. It does exactly that, and it does it not only in terms of psychology and repression, but it does it also in terms of economic policy and political action. It does it in both respects, and it puts up an alternative which would be suitable for the Labour Party, possible in other places. But just let me summarise what that alternative is, to give you an example that the book is practical. The book is something that should be read by every Labour Party supporter and member. It's fairly critical of Labour under economic rationalism, but it gives them all a fair go, people like Keating, and it does put up the alternative in a way that no one else does. Now, looking at that alternative in simple language, it's full employment, not economic growth. We've all become committed to economic growth, and full employment is no longer an objective.
And yet people forget that it was absolutely central to Australian policy, to bipartisan policy.
It was central to a period from 1950 to 1975, most of it under Menzies, which provided the best life experience for young people that this country has ever been able to provide. Full employment did.
Unemployment. But Jim, you're describing an era when there was also psychological repression for young people, surely.
Yes, the psychological repression was there, and probably worse than it is now. There's been a certain liberation from that, although it's a negative liberation. It's not an alternative in the sense of what they might do. But full employment, not economic growth, is the first thing I'm saying. Now, we've got 9% of unemployment now, and it is irreducible under present policy, because to reduce it, and full employment certainly, depends on a high level of government spending. Now, we can't possibly have a high level of government spending for a number of reasons that nobody ever points out, and none of the academics or the media writers who are semi-academic pointed out. The main reason is that in the last 15 years, the ownership of Australian, the economic structure, has moved up into foreign hands from $300 billion to $900 billion. Now, that means that taxation paid by those who own all that is paid overseas, not in Australia. That means that the economic structure, the big business, the moderate business, pays only about 10% of total tax income to the government. The rest is paid mostly by individuals who average about 25 or 30%.
Well, Jim, that's if it's paid
in
at all.
In taxation.
That's if it's paid at all.
If it's paid at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I was never able to get last year satisfactory answers from the taxation department about that, but we can be sure it's got down as far as 10%. Now, the reason, the consequence of that is that the government doesn't have an income. Therefore, if it's going to govern at all, it's had to have deficits in the past. And the Liberals have been going to a lot of trouble to point out that the deficits in the last 4 or 5 years of the Keating government came to over $20 billion. They had deficit because that income from foreign-owned corporations has fallen to almost nothing, that they couldn't increase taxation on individuals because taxation increased on them is a vote loser under any circumstances. So governments have their hands tied to bring about the expenditure that is necessary to deal with unemployment, certainly to get anywhere near full employment.
Jim, some of them actually want to have their hands tied. They are so ideologically driven by economic rationalism that
I think they are.
This is their favourite position, really.
Yes, I think they want to have their hands tied. I don't think it avoids.
They're happy in that bondage, aren't they?
That's right.
They submit to it.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Jim, but there's no way out of this impasse, is there? Do you see a method of?
Well, the way I see it is talking to Philip Adams for an hour today.
Well, Gladys is listening, but, you know, we're a tiny audience, Jim.
Oh, yes, I know, but it all adds up. I talked to Bert Newton last week, and I'll be talking to Doug Aitken next week. I do well with radio and television more than anything compared to the media. The media really is not, somehow or other, they think my written stuff is too, I suppose, too complex.
But, Jim, you do something else which many people find almost unbearably poignant. You take your books, you put them on a card table, and you sell them personally at markets. Now, people find this deeply shocking. They find it extraordinary that a guy who was the Treasurer, Deputy Prime Minister, who was that close to being the leader of one of the great parties of this country, the guy that led 100,000 people through the streets of Melbourne, now deals in this intimate, direct, and slightly tatty way with the wider world. But you like that, don't you? You enjoy that.
I would rather I didn't have to do it, Philip, but I have to do it for a number of reasons. One is that each of those books is read by 5,000 or 6,000 people and is read pretty thoroughly. And you'd be surprised how many of them emerge after reading that book, very changed people.
So you're back to the lecture room in a way, aren't you? The audience is not insignificant.
In a way, I've never been out of it.
But you don't just sell the books. You actually talk to people, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yes, talk a lot to people. And I learn a lot. I always come back with a notebook with two or three pages of notes taken from every time I go to a market or anywhere else. I said this is the last book I'll ever write. Now, I've said that
before. Oh, you always say that, Jim.
Once or twice.
You always.
Now, I've already discovered that this last book can be much improved, Philip.
Mm.
Now, I don't know what I'm going to do about that, but it's something I've got to face up to in the next 12 months.
Now, okay, let me just see where you are at the moment. You left Marks way behind. You've come back in a way to Keynes. What about Reich? Are you still as passionately a devotee?
I think Reich is more correct than anyone else. I think his study of the rise of fascism in Germany was a perfect study, more complete than anything else, puts Hitler completely in context. I think it explains the religious battles going on in the Middle East and in the old Yugoslavian area completely. I think Reich has more relevance today than ever before.
You don't think that perhaps, Jim, you extrapolated from your own experience of repression and have made it perhaps too important? In other words, I could never quite see. I know I could see how deeply you felt it. I mean, you made this very public. You didn't muck about. We knew what you were going through. But it seemed to me that many of us hadn't gone through this repression and it wasn't such an issue. I mean, in the same way, of course, Freud extrapolated from deep personal experience and created a whole philosophy and you know, perhaps a science out of it.
Well, that's possible, but after all, if this is not the explanation for what has gone wrong, what is? This is a very tenable, a very rational explanation for what has gone wrong.
Well, you hinted at something before, Jim. Let's look at a world now where the repression, certainly the sexual repression that one felt, that was palpable in the Menzies era, here and everywhere. That's been exploded. Now, you say it's been replaced by a pseudo-freedom. I think that was the term you used, or something very like it. What do you mean by that?
It's a freedom that still finds it unable to handle properly sexual and organic function.
It's still ashamed of it, is it, Jim?
Yes, it's still hidden. There's still a phobia. There's still a fear. It's not as it was in 1921 when the Archbishop of Melbourne put out a pastoral letter condemning women for revealing their shameful members on the beach at St Kilda when you could see up to their knees and up to their elbows, and said they were neglecting the clothes that God had given them to hide their shameful members.
Well, Jim, these days the popular women's mags have cover stories about how to obtain multiple orgasm or how to masturbate a lover. I mean, in this world, surely the triumph of Reich is absolute.
I think it has gone very considerably on, but at the same time, masturbation?
No, multiple orgasms. It's orgasm. Something that I must say I very rarely experience, but
yes.
They write about them in the women's mags.
Yeah, well, maybe they do, and I don't think they would achieve it very much. But at the same time, the test of a human relationship with me is the degree to which there is genuine affection or love, genuine intelligent communication.
So, in other words, this freedom does not necessarily bring with it affection,
it doesn't bring
mutual respect.
This freedom is a result of reacting to repression, not removing it.
Jim, does it occur to you that what you were getting in the 60s, in the 70s, was in fact a form of love? The public adulation you had was certainly tinged with it. You were regarded by many people as infinitely more charismatic than Whitlam, or certainly more than Hawke later on. And you were the focus of hopes and dreams. You were embodied with all... It was a very heavy burden that you took on. But you were getting something out of that, Jim. You were getting the acclamation and the loyalty of vast numbers of people. Was that not, for you, a form, if you like, of eroticism, of lovemaking?
Well, I didn't feel it as strong as you've just described it, Philip. If you're right, I wasn't as fully aware of it by any means.
You were repressed, Jim.
Probably. Yes, certainly. But I wasn't as much aware of it if it was as you say. I think it was of significance. I think they did think, a quarter, maybe more, all over Australia did think I was different from the other politicians.
Well, that could hardly be a doubt, Jim.
No, that's right, and it's not a very great compliment either. But now, how much different? I think they thought I didn't put self first, that there were other things that I thought were more important than putting self first.
Well, there was your quite self-sacrificial performance in regard to Junie Morosi. You know, you didn't run away or hide. You copped that. You stood up there and you talked very publicly, often somewhat enigmatically, about the nature of that relationship. No one in public life had ever done that.
I suppose not. It wasn't to say a relationship with another woman by a politician was not very common. It was very common.
But very secret, Jim.
Yes, and very much very utilitarian, very pushing them aside, giving them no value other than the whatever it was that came from it. But that was unusual, yes. But I don't know how much unusual.
Jim, you were the eye of a very big storm, but let's not sort of focus too much on that. When I was reading through piles of stuff about you, I came upon a reference. Let me see if I can find it. It's here somewhere. I'm not sure what book's this from. It's from a book called The Reformers. Here it is. The objective observer would probably see Cairns as one of the tragedies of Australian politics, a left-winger who reached great political heights but blew the immense opportunities the politics gave him, victim of himself as much as of circumstances, unable ultimately to turn circumstances and opportunities to effect. Do you see yourself in that? Do you feel that you're one of the tragedies of Australian politics? Or do you feel that you made a considerable contribution and that you can rest to some extent on the laurels you've collected?
Well, the point about that quote you've just given is the term blew the opportunities. Now, presumably that would be in 1975 or so, when I was sacked from the Whitlam government and...
You were dismissed before the dismissal, weren't you?
Yes, four months
fairly
before.
Opportune. Good timing, Jim.
Yeah, I told Whitlam it would happen to him too, of course. But the point I make here is blew the opportunities is completely invalid. That statement you've just read to me is based upon that. It doesn't devalue what I might have had along the lines of what you were saying that I had a while ago. I was widely admired and respected and all that, and I was telling you you were going too far. But that statement not only ignores that altogether, but it attaches itself to the words blew the opportunities. Now, I want to deal with that point, blew the opportunities. I make the point, Philip, that by the beginning of 1975, the Whitlam government was finished. Whether it had been led by Whitlam or me or by anyone else, it was finished. Certainly, as led by Whitlam, it was finished. Whitlam had sacked and dismissed, I think, three or four ministers and a speaker in the space of 6 months. He was strongly suspected by Kerr, the Governor-General. That suspicion was being fed by the authorities here and in America. Kerr was looking for an opportunity to dismiss Whitlam. All this I knew and read from the words of Kerr himself, and I knew and told Whitlam about it. And Whitlam was facing dismissal before the end of 1975. Now, there's one thing only that he could have done, and no one knows how it would have worked. He could have recommended the replacement of Kerr first. And I suppose Her Majesty would have had to agree to the appointment of another Governor-General. But at that stage, Whitlam was completely incapable of a decision of that kind. Now, I'm making the point that the opportunities in 1975 for a Labor government or for a Labour leader of any sort was no opportunity. I didn't blow the opportunity, I went out with it.
Jim, they're not my words. I don't see you in this way at all.
No.
I see you as someone who has lived, and in fact is living, an extraordinary life in which you continue to change, to reconsider positions, and I find great courage in that. To me, you are one of the most valiant and most vulnerable people I've ever met. And, well, of course, vulnerable is not a pejorative term. It's marvellous to talk to you again, Jim. It's been a while since we've had a chat. We should do this every year, you know.
Well, let's make up our minds to do it every year. You approach me, I think, over this one. I'll undertake to approach you next year over the next one.
Well, Jim, I hope so. And don't make it the last book. You've got another seven or eight in you yet, haven't you?
Maybe one. Yeah, I'll try.
The late Jim Cairns talking to me in 1996. Jim was, of course, an anti-war and social change activist. He was an academic, he was a copper, and he was a theorist. And he had some very odd theories, I've got to tell you. He was Deputy Prime Minister to Gough Whitlam, who hated every minute of it, and Jim died at the age of 89 in October 2003. We'll be back same time, same place next week with another Classic LNL, and send in your suggestions. See you later.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.